There's a growing number of women like Monique in leadership positions in Australian medicine and healthcare, but according to an editorial in the Medical Journal of Australia, the glass ceiling is yet to be broken, which is ironic since male domination of medical student numbers disappeared long ago. So you have probably a majority of medical graduates being women, yet the bosses are mostly men, which presumably creates distortions in training, quality and service to us as consumers. I remember a story where I was doing some focus group work with people with chronic illness and talking to them about their GPs, and they said they didn't have any problems with their GPs because she looks after us really well. In other words, their search was always for a female to get the care they wanted. The author of this editorial is a medical leader and has been one for many years, Professor Helena Teed, who's Executive Director of Monash Partners Academic Health Sciences Centre in Melbourne and an endocrinologist at Monash Health. And with Helena is Elizabeth Sigston, who's a consultant ear, nose and throat surgeon, also at Monash Health. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Helena, what are the stats?
So you're absolutely right, Norman. We know that in medical school, it was really a couple of decades ago now, that we had an equivalent or if not higher proportion of the students coming through who were actually women. And for a long time, the argument was, well, we'll wait in the pipeline, and as those women get older and naturally evolve into more leadership positions, we'll see that change. And that hasn't happened. In fact, The Lancet described it as a leaky pipeline. So we've still got a real preponderance of anywhere from 3% of our surgeons in some fields are women. And in leadership roles, it's around 10 to 12% in our senior leadership roles in some areas that are women.
What are the causes of the leaks?
Oh, there are many causes.
Well, I mean, but actually, a leak sounds benign rather than a barrier, but then we'll come back to that in a moment.
Yes, true. So in essence, we now know what causes it. And there's been some really good research in Australia that's shown that it's actually rarely now people thinking that women don't deserve or aren't interested or shouldn't be able to participate in leadership in a whole range of areas. It really comes down now to three
things. So there's fewer male farts around?
Well,
Your words.
That's a good way of putting it. So now it's really three things. It's the capability that women have to participate in these sorts of leadership roles, and that's primarily
perceived capability or real capability?
Exactly. It's perceived capability. A lot of it is about confidence. So we know that to get women to apply for a job, they need to tick all 10 criteria often before they'll even apply. Our male colleagues will generally do that when they tick 4 or 5 out of 10 criteria.
Thinking, I can do this, no problem.
Yes. And women will often require a mentor to encourage them or tap them on the shoulder rather than putting themselves forward for awards, positions, etc. So there is a perceived confidence, a perceived concern about capability, and that's also a way that, about the way we promote people within our workplace. It's just different for many women than perhaps it is for our male colleagues. Women don't go and network on the golf course for their next position.
So what's the impact here? I mean, is healthcare the less for this?
Yes, so we do know that in all areas, whether it's health or anywhere, that equity and diversity, one, is more reflective of our community and therefore make sure that healthcare has a voice around that. But also we know that a more diverse, heterogeneous group is much more likely to reflect the needs of the community and much more likely to address the health service and healthcare needs across the spectrum.
Elizabeth Sigston, you were the first mother to be taken into an advanced surgical training program. In other words, you already had kids and you were about to go into subspecialty training in ear, nose and throat surgery.
That's right, Norman. In fact, I went into general surgery first. I had my daughter when I was a third year resident and was accepted into general surgery just after she was born.
So just describe, I mean, obviously you'd like to become a leader, and I think from what little I know of you, you actually are recognised by your colleagues these days as a leader in ENT surgery and a pusher and a mover and shaker. But just describe your journey there and what you've discovered. Because I think that what you've discovered is that the more you get into it, the more attitudes and barriers you're finding.
I think you're exactly right. When I was more junior, and certainly when I was applying at the time, I did have a number of surgeons sort of point out that, you know, when they went through, to be male and married was considered a barrier to becoming a surgeon. And here I was female, I was married, and I had a baby. And the question was, do you really think you're going to be a surgeon? And I hadn't thought that that was not possible. I was lucky I was in an environment where I was well supported and was able to proceed with that.
But that's getting your ticket as an ear, nose and throat surgeon. What about becoming a leader and actually you know, taking people forward to a place that they haven't been before?
That's definitely challenging. I spent a number of years as executive director of our unit and worked very closely with our head of unit to help build our unit at Monash into one of the most efficient units that we have. And I think we've moved to where women are accepted into being, I guess, if you'd like to say, seen as the supporter role. We do things, and I think we're very welcome in that area. When we wish
so
to start.
So they're throwing stuff over the fence to you rather than giving you the leadership?
Yeah, I think so. Well, here's the problem. Find a solution, you know, and we're very good at that. I think where I've noticed the barriers is when you actually want to start changing the structure of things and changing the way people perceive leadership. So, for example, leadership in a hierarchical system is very much attached to the position. But just because you have the position doesn't mean that you're a leader. And that's a big shift in thinking particularly in surgery where that's the traditional model. For us to build better and a more collaborative healthcare system, we need to start engaging everybody in a role of leadership.
And Helena, I mean, that's one of the things that probably women bring more than men is the notion of team building as a leader.
Yes, so we have to be a little bit careful here because they're often the stereotypes, but the masculine style of, or traditionally masculine style of leadership, which is not the way all males wish to behave, but is much more command, control, top down. And that includes the way we treat our patients, whereas the traditionally feminine style of leadership is distributive, collective, much more about engaging and supporting each other, and also our patients. So there is that stereotype, but yes, women have a preference for that more distributive leadership type of style, and they therefore tend to be more transformative. So a balance would be to have a diverse leadership group that really reflected the equity and diversity of our society.
Elizabeth, how have you had to change your behaviour in order to become a leader?
That's a very good question, Norman. I think when I've started, I think the models that we have are very much, as Helena said, is the command and control. And there's certainly situations, particularly in surgery, where you need that. If I have someone who's got an airway that's in danger, I will be telling people what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. But we need to also spend as much time in investing in skills in leadership as we do in our surgical skills. And that's quite a different skill. And what we've done is taken some of that surgical model and applied it to leadership, and maybe it doesn't really work.
But people have got to start listening.
And I think part of the reason when we talk about having that ability to switch between different styles of leadership, that's not just for women, that's for men as well. And by having more women in leadership positions, we potentially are providing an alternative role model that other men can also model themselves on and see that there are different ways to the ones that have been traditionally on view.
Helena, influential of the Health Report is an interview won't necessarily change things. What are the solutions here?
So now that we know that a lot of it's about the capability, also the capacity of women, the critical issue around parenting. So we know that women work the same hours in medicine as men until the age of usually onset of first children. They drop down for about 5 years as a critical career stage and then have much less opportunity after that. And the other issue, Norman, is credibility, that we don't see women as our GPs or cardiologists, et cetera. But the answer is...
Well, they do increasingly.
Increasingly, yes, you're right. So the answer really is about taking much more of a systems level approach. So the evidence now starts to show us that you can help the individual, and leadership training and capacity building is very powerful, as is mentoring and having organisational changes around this as well. So that capacity building, leadership and mentoring and role modelling.
But often in this situation, it's women who realise they need the training and not men. So you find women queuing up for these training schemes and men not.
Yes, perhaps we should take our male colleagues with us. You're absolutely right. But I think all of us, as Liz suggested, just because you're a doctor and you happen to have been, you know, reasonably bright and work incredibly hard and have technical skills does not mean you have leadership skills. And we need to think about that much more broadly and build on that leadership. So there's now a national initiative, Norman, across the colleges, across the health services, across government, where people are coming together and saying, we really need to do something about this, and we need to do it at a systems level, and we need to change so that people don't have to fight to get what they really should be able to have the opportunities to have.
Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Helena Teed and Elizabeth Sixton, thanks very much for joining us on the Health Report.
Thanks very much.
Helena Teed is Executive Director of Monash Partners Academic Health Research Translation Centre. She's also an endocrinologist at Monash Health. And Elizabeth Sixton is a head and neck cancer surgeon and an ENT surgeon, also at Monash Health. I'm Norman Swan. You've been listening to The Health Report. See you next week.